Earth and Sky.
You know, climate change is so incredibly complex. It's endlessly fascinating. But the one thing about it that I think stands out as being the most important is that it is the challenge of our generation. It is a global challenge. It can only be met globally. So this is a test for the world. Can the world learn to cooperate on this challenge?
You're listening to economist Scott Barrett of Columbia University, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. Barrett is a world expert on environmental treaties. Just days before the United Nations meeting on climate change in Copenhagen, Barrett spoke about the difficulties and strategies for crafting a successful climate treaty with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Dr. Barrett, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
Thank you very much.
Now, world leaders will gather in Copenhagen in December of 2009 as part of the United Nations Climate Change Conference to possibly craft a new environmental treaty on climate beyond Kyoto. What would a successful climate treaty look like?
I think most people think a successful climate treaty would be one in which countries, and especially the rich countries, undertake to meet binding targets and timetables for reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. But I don't think that would be a successful treaty. What would be a successful treaty would be if the agreement changed the way the countries behaved, if it caused countries to reduce their emissions, if it stimulated a technological revolution that made it possible for greater reductions to be achieved in the future, if all of this led eventually to the stabilization of greenhouse concentrations at a level that would prevent dangerous climate change. It's much more important that an agreement change behavior than that it say things that sound good.
Do you think the world needs a climate agreement, and why or why not?
I'm glad you asked that question. The answer is a very loud yes. Now, the reason it's a good question is that people are frustrated. We've been working at this for a very long time, and all the negotiations so far have produced very little fruit. So I understand why people are frustrated, but that frustration tells us that this is a colossal collective action problem. It doesn't tell us that there's a better way to address the problem. You know, one way to understand this is if you look at what countries have tried to do unilaterally. When the whole interest in climate change emerged in the very late 1980s and into the early 1990s, countries were actually at that point pledging to reduce their emissions unilaterally. And it was only as they came to understand the challenge of doing, the difficulty of doing that, and the need for any one country's actions to be effective being linked to other countries taking action, it was really only then that it became absolutely clear that an agreement was needed. That's still true today. And you see this in a lot of different ways. For example, the European Union has recently pledged, and by the way, it's done this year after year after year for a very long time. So, you know, the rhetoric is one thing. And what I'm concerned about, obviously, is the effect of actions on addressing the climate problem. But they have recently pledged that Europe would reduce its emissions 20% from the 1990 level by 2020 and by 30% if the other rich countries, the other OECD countries, do the same thing. That is, that Europe is making its pledge contingent. Japan has done the same thing. The new prime minister has pledged to reduce emissions by Japan by about 25% in 2020. But again, that is contingent on all the other rich countries adopting the same obligations. Now, the United States is interesting because in the United States, the focus very much has been domestically in this last year. And the House of Representatives has passed a bill on climate change to reduce U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases. But the first full paragraph in this bill says that the U.S. government will report to Congress and to the public on whether China and India are undertaking actions that will have an equivalent effect of U.S. policy. That is, it's implicit here that what the United States is pledging to do is contingent on these other large, fast-growing developing countries taking similar action. And this, by the way, without any negotiation involving these other countries, which really, I think, puts into question the legitimacy of this approach. So it's because all countries are saying they'll act, but they'll only act if others act, that you need to have an agreement. What we need to focus on is not an alternative way of addressing the problem, because there really isn't a good alternative way. What we need to focus on is designing an agreement that will really change behavior.
What are your thoughts on comparing global warming to the ozone problem of the 1980s with CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons? Getting back to the Copenhagen Climate Treaty that is coming up in December 2009, this may be a way to tackle that problem.
Yes, actually, if everyone's looking for some good news and some inspiration, it's there. It's just that very few people have talked about it. The ozone problem and the climate problem are interrelated in very complex ways. The ozone itself in the stratosphere is actually a greenhouse gas. The chemicals that deplete ozone in the stratosphere are greenhouse gases, and the chemicals that substitute for those ozone-destroying gases are greenhouse gases. So it's a very complicated matter to work out the effect of addressing ozone depletion on climate change. But scientists have done the calculations, and their results are astonishing. They found that the Montreal Protocol, without ever really even intending to address the climate problem, has done as much. Well, first of all, let me say that Montreal has done about as much as it is technically possible to do to address the problem of ozone depletion. It is astonishing and one of the greatest successes of international cooperation in human history. So that's the first thing. But even on as regards the climate, because of these complex interlinkages between the two problems, the Montreal Protocol has done about four times as much as the Kyoto Protocol ever aspired to achieve, and that's assuming that you had full participation, full compliance, and so on. So as the world is focused on Copenhagen and how to craft an agreement on climate, focusing on targets and timetables and so on, really stuck in the same rut we've been in for a very long time, almost without anyone noticing it, a different approach has succeeded much better. And I think part of the lesson of that is that we could provide some leverage off of this success and achieve even more. And in particular, there is a chemical that is also a greenhouse gas that is controlled under the Kyoto Protocol. These are called HFCs. And this chemical is not covered under the Montreal Protocol. However, it has all the same kinds of commercial properties as all the other chemicals that are covered under Montreal. And we could address that one gas either by bringing it in under the Montreal Protocol and controlling it directly under that agreement, or better yet, in my view, designing an agreement that looks very much like Montreal, but that would be a separate agreement under the Framework Convention on Climate Change targeted directly on addressing HFCs. Now, this approach, which we could do, by the way, for Copenhagen, this is actually a much easier problem to negotiate than the very large, ambitious negotiations that are underway now. This approach will work, and we know it'll work because the Montreal Protocol has worked. So I think that not only is there inspiration in the Montreal Protocol, there also is a kind of a model there for how we can go forward. Now, the HFCs are one small part of the big problem. And it's not as if you can control those and then be content and think that you're done with the problem. You're not. But once you start to see that you can make greater success by taking out this one gas and addressing it separately using one kind of agreement, then you might start thinking, well, maybe we could take out another gas and address that separately. And maybe for a gas like carbon dioxide, which of course is the most important of all, maybe the way to deal with that is not to set economy-wide targets and timetables. Maybe the way to deal with that is to break it up by looking at individual sectors and then asking, do we have leverage on reducing the emissions from some sectors better than other sectors? Or can we perhaps do it in different ways? I think that if we conceive of the problem differently and allow the possibility of breaking up into pieces, we'll actually be able to use much greater leverage in reducing emissions overall.
You've been listening to economist Scott Barrett, the Linfest Earth Institute Professor of Natural Resource Economics at Columbia University. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
We're at earthsky.org.